And last week we talked about the seals that were placed at the end of each of the four Gospels. You can think of them as the good housekeeping seal of approval. That's right. That's basically what they were for the writers of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. At the end of the process of transcribing from their notes into the manuscripts that we have, then they sealed them at the end with a mark that indicated that they approved what the scribe had done. That seems to be the situation. And also, as John pointed out, and at the end of his manuscript, he put it on the word true. This is the witness who saw all of these things, and I testify that his words are true. He's talking about himself. And so that's the purpose of the seals, and we talked about that last week. None of the other manuscripts of the New Testament Gospels have seals at the ends, and so that leads us to believe that it's possible that these are the original transcriptions of the scribes while the authors were present. We talked a little bit about at the end of last week's lesson about the fact that putting together a story like this, particularly one of the Gospels, where we're going to send this throughout the world, it's part of the Great Commission, wasn't it? To go into all the world and teach the gospel to everybody. And that's what these men were hoping to do by publishing their copies of the Good News, each of them from a slightly different perspective. And at different times, they showed up in Egypt at this scriptorium where the scribe took their materials and made it into a chapter of the book. These four gospels were put together, bound together in a wooden-covered book, and were used as we'll see later on, were used as the origin, the words of origin of the Gospels that we have even today. So, that's where we are, and today we're going to talk about something else that was put at the ends of each of these four Gospels, and we'll get into that, special kind of symbols that are put there. And we think they answer the question. And this is a conjecture. Realize I can't prove this, but Lee Woodard, who's the one who did the, Dr. Lee Woodard did the original examination of these four manuscripts in modern times. He thinks that that's the case, and I agree with him. When were they written? That's what those symbols at the end are supposed to tell us. But unfortunately, we don't have any guidance as to how to interpret them, so we kind of have to solve the puzzle by looking at them, and that's what we're going to do this morning. Now remember, all of these New Testament manuscripts come from this Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts up at Plano, Texas, and they insist that we put a little advertisement at the start of these presentations. Also realize that the research was originally done by Lee W. Woodard in modern times, beginning in the 1980s. He spent 15 years working over these manuscripts before he finally published something. But, of course, the early work was done way back when the manuscripts were first bought by Freer and taken to the Smithsonian Institution. He had a scholar at the University of Michigan go over them, who did some sort of cursory examination of them and some estimations and didn't really take his work very seriously, Lee Woodard thinks, and I tend to agree with him. And remember, we're talking about ways of convincing somebody who has a modern view of the Bible that says it's all sort of mythology, it was all cobbled together years after the event, and maybe Jesus was real, but he probably couldn't do miracles, and his story is probably put together by Christians after they decided he was important. Well, that's not the case. This study should be evidence you can present to someone who's a skeptic about the Bible. These manuscripts go right back to the first century. Now, whether or not they were touched by the authors, I think they probably were. And that very thought, it sort of sends goosebumps down your spine to think that we're looking at pages that were touched by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the implication of having their seal at the end of it, as we talked about last week. So how can we decide when these manuscripts were written? And the way the scholars looked at it in the 100 years ago, and even back further than that, was basically by an examination of the font and the style of the writing. Now, also they looked at the type of Greek and the details of the Greek grammar and that sort of thing to describe how old they were. But first of all, an examination of the font and the style. The older texts, as we talked about in the beginning, are all uppercase Greek letters. And lowercase Greek didn't come into use for hundreds of years after the Gospels were written. The ink can sometimes date the document to some extent. The scientists take a careful examination of flecks of ink taken from the paper and take it apart and see whether or not it contains iron or other kinds of minerals. And some kinds of ink were present. This kind of an examination can perhaps date a document to within 100 years or so, and it can certainly tell whether a document is ancient or more recent. And so somebody who is trying to forge a document like this in modern times will have trouble synthesizing an ink that looks like it should have looked if it was done in the first century. But that's a possibility. The vellum, and now the vellum is the parchment upon which the manuscripts are written, and that sometimes can be dated with carbon-14 analysis. It's a product of living things. It's the skin of either a sheep or a goat. And so it can be dated with carbon-14 analysis to probably within 50 years if it's clean. It's not badly contaminated. It's difficult to clean an ancient biological material that may contain a lot of modern germs. And the germs, of course, are also biological. If any of you have ever looked at the stories about the Shroud of Turin, you remember that? It's made out of some kind of cloth, and they're arguing about when was it assembled, and carbon-14 dating wasn't very definitive about that because it had been contaminated not only by dirt and bacteria and things like that, but gone through a fire. And, of course, smoke is biological, too, organic materials that are burned. So that's ambiguous. And some manuscripts, though, and we're going to talk about this third item today, some manuscripts may have an indication at the end of the manuscript that indicates when it was written, a special symbol placed there. Now, why not just write out this manuscript was copied in 73 B.C.? Well, they didn't have A.D. and B.C. in those days. And in fact, no one was keeping a very accurate calendar historically. Now, the historians were upset about that sort of thing, and so they had a procedure that would give them some indication of the time that had passed between events. That's really what they were looking for, rather than to get an absolute date for an event. But so they were thinking about this. The AD-BC kind of a concept only came into being and after the Catholic Church worked on that in the early 500s AD. And see, that's sometime after these manuscripts were put together. And they decided to go back and try to decide when Jesus was born and so they could date things in the year of our Lord. That's what AD means. And so they could date them as so many years since Jesus was born. And anything before that was BC, of course, before Christ. So So that's the case. Now, we have in the Bible some attempts to place dates on events. And Luke, the third chapter, which I ask you to read in preparation for today, these are the early verses. The first three or four verses gives you a good idea about this. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, and let's see, I'm closer to it up here. When Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea, and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the desert. He went into all the country around the Jordan, preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sin. So Luke establishes pretty specifically when John began his preaching this way. And that can establish a date for an event. But what about the writing of that event? It would have to be after the event, of course, to be recorded. But it could be any time after that. And so it doesn't really fix a date for the description, for the writing of Luke, for example. Okay. So Codex W has a symbol at the end of each of the Gospels. And this is Matthew's symbol, where the red arrow is down here. Remember, we talked about his seal last time, which is this spot right here. But there's this symbol here, something that looks like a bird with some lines above and below it and a long tail on it. And if we look at that more closely, you can get an idea of what we have here. Some horizontal lines which start out as dots and spread out. Here's the bird sitting on one of these lines and some more lines down below. And over here I've numbered them. He's sitting on the eighth line from the bottom, and there are seven lines above him. And so what does that mean? Well, now here's the tail of the bird which stretches out across the manuscript. And as a matter of fact, all four of them have a tail like that. Although Mark, the last of the four Gospels, remember the order here is Matthew, John, Luke, and Mark. That's not the order that they are in our Bible, but the order doesn't matter, perhaps. I think the sequence that we have depends upon the age of those manuscripts, when they were actually compiled. But the order that they put them here in Codex W seems to be on the importance that Matthew and John were both apostles, so they're put first. So I think you have this particular slide in the handout on one side there. And so how are we going to interpret this, and why didn't they just write on there that this was a particular date? Well, they did have the possibility of writing a date, surprisingly. And in the Roman Empire, everything was dated from the founding of their most famous city, which would be Rome. That's right. How was Rome founded? Anybody remember that story? There were a pair of twin brothers, Romulus and Remus. That's right. And Rome is named after Romulus. At least that's thought to be the case. And they set out the story. It seems as though a lot of the history, the mythology about Remus and Romulus was borrowed from the Old Testament, really. All sorts of mythological things that happened to them, but they were twin brothers, and it, as it turned out, Romulus killed Remus the way Cain killed Abel, but before that happened, they were put in a basket in a river and rescued from the river like Moses, and so I don't know why, I guess they couldn't think of anything original, they just copied things that the Jews had spread around the world, but anyway, that happened apparently in a pretty well established date, about 754 BC. Think back, what was happening to the Jews in 754 BC? Well, if you look on some of the timelines we've been studying in Wednesday night last year, or Sunday night, I guess it was, that Ken presented to us, we had some of the kings of divided Israel at that point, and I think it was Uzziah who was the king of Judah at that point in time. And so we have history going on. It was before the time of Alexander the Great. It was before the Persians even. And so we have this history going on that the Romans were proud of. And so they founded Rome the way the Allen brothers founded Houston. You remember how that happened? Any of you were around when that took place? When was Houston founded? When did they start Houston? About 1845 or 6 or somewhere along in there. Where did they start the city? On the banks of the Buffalo Bayou, right? They laid it out, square streets and avenues, and invited people to come buy land, and that's how Houston started. And it has a specific date, and it grew up from there to a great city. Well, the same thing happened with Rome. Rome was not really a little village beforehand, before Romulus set that up, Remus and Romulus, and they actually started it from scratch, but it had a different name for the first 100 years or so. It wasn't called Rome until after the fact. Well, so the Romans were counting the years from that event. And it's called Anno Urbis Conditate, or Ditate. That's Latin, incidentally, not Greek. But the idea is from the founding of the city of Rome in 754 B.C. Now, that date is argued, if you look it up on the Internet, I found a lot of sites that said 753. We're not going to quibble over a year here, okay? Everybody understand that. And so we'll accept 754. By the year 1 B.C., 754 B.C., there's 754 years have passed, see? And 1 A.D. is year A.U.C. We'll just abbreviate it instead of A.D. and B.C. B.C., we'll call it A.U.C., Anno Urbis Conditate. And so year 1 A.D. is 755. Our math doesn't work that way because we would insist that there should have been a year zero. But you wouldn't want to be born in a year zero, would you? So it was either 1 B.C. or 1 A.D. So there's a year missing there in terms of the math. But again, we're not going to quibble over 1 year. To convert AUC dates to AD dates, we simply subtract 754. And so AUC 827 minus 754 would be 73 AD. That's just an example. But that's how that conversion comes about. And historians were using that in New Testament times. They were using it in Old Testament times, too, although it wasn't widely publicized. But Lee Woodard thinks that the AUC dating is what the scribes are using here in these symbols at the bottom of the, at the end of each of the Gospels. Now, here's the dating symbol of John's Gospel. And it's a similar kind of thing. Looks just like the one that we had for Matthew. So here's something that looks like a pretty well-defined bird, and some lines and dots below it, some lines and dots above it, some kind of a splotch obliterated part of this line, but apparently there was a line across there, and then a long, fancy tail out across the manuscript. Now, if you count these lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 above, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 below, they're the same numbers that were used in Matthew's. The birds look alike. What's that mean? Well, why a bird? I think because birds are annual events, aren't they? You read in the the news just last week. Fort Worth was overcome by a huge flock of grackles. We've had that down here. They aren't very precise about their migration. But some birds are. Have you ever heard about the buzzards arriving in Hinckley, Ohio? On a certain date, a huge flock of buzzards always shows up at that point. And, of course, the swallows come back to where? Capistrano. On a particular date. How do the birds know when a date is, you see? Some birds are very precise in their migration. It's an annual event. And that led Lee Woodard to think, well, this has something to do with the date. And particularly when you look at the lines, if there's seven or eight lines above and below, what kinds of information would the scribe want to record about a particular manuscript? And we're going to see some figures like this on some later manuscripts as well. The lines above and below are turned into dots, but they're counted the same way. And about the same number of lines, seven lines above the middle section of the figure. We'll look at that. So what kinds of information would the scribe want like to fix on these figures? And I think Lee Woodard is correct, and I agree with him, that they would want to fix the time in which the manuscript was copied. But they might also, and I don't think Lee Woodard thought about this, they might also want to fix the time at which the document was written. Because the making of this manuscript might have come some time after the document was first written. In fact, we'll see evidence of that in just a minute. So I'm going to suggest to you something that isn't in the... There's a fifth conclusion we'll look at the end down here, and you can prepare yourself to copy that off into the margin. I didn't have room on the page. And any conclusions that we draw about these documents, about these manuscript figures, has to be a guess, because we don't have anybody spelling out how to look at this and decide. Okay, well, let's look at the other two. Here's Luke's symbol. Here again, it's a bird with a fancy tail. It stretches out across the manuscript. Lines above and lines below. But when you count them here, there's a difference. There's eight lines above and eight lines below. And then this long tail, in every case, the tails are different. And that may just be because we think that all of these manuscripts are written, were transcribed by the same scribe, he may just be pointing out that there's a variety of ways of doing the tails. But all of that must mean something. I mean, why do they bother to put these on each of the manuscripts? Now, the one for Mark is different. It's a wiggledy line, a helix running all the way from top to bottom, and a tail that goes across like this. And that turns out to be a symbol that seems to indicate the end of the book, the end of the codex, because one like that shows up on the book of John, which was the last of the Gospels in Sinaiticus. We'll look at that. So hang on to that thought. I can't tell you all of these things all at once. I have to do them one at a time. But anyway, here's Mark's. And you can see, here's his seal. But he has something here that looks like a tail of a bird, but there's no bird. And on the other hand, he has a vertical helix here that makes eight turns at the top. And then some more down here. And it's hard to count down here in the decay of the vellum, but there seems to be eight on the bottom as well. And then a helix going across here with some decorations on it. So let's look at all of them at once. Here's Matthew. Now, Matthew had chevrons separated by dots. John has a helix decorated with some sort of, maybe they're feathers on the tail of the bird. Luke has a double helix with dots in the helix. And Mark has a helix with decorations on it. But Mark's vertical line looks like John's tail. So we're left, how are we going to interpret this? And what Lee Woodard said we should do, and I think he's probably right, is look at the units in the tail as years. The lines above and below the bird, now he didn't distinguish the fact that sometimes there were seven above and sometimes eight. I think when there are seven lines above, it indicates that the manuscript was written before AD 46. AD 46 is a key date because that's the 800th anniversary of the founding of Rome. If you subtract 754, you see, from 800, you're left with 46. So 46 AD would have been the 800th anniversary of the founding of Rome. Anything written before 46 AD would have been assembled during the 700s. You follow me there? And so it was copied, because there are eight lines below the bird, it was copied in the 800s, and so it was copied after 46 AD. But it may have been composed before 46 AD, because Jesus lived from when? His ministry was around AD 30, wasn't it? 3.5 years, maybe from 26 to 31 or somewhere in that range. And so the apostles had time, they had at least 15 years there to put their thoughts together and make notes and look at their records that they had assembled and then put together the story. They probably wrote these stories, except for Luke, they probably wrote them in Aramaic and then had them translated into Greek. So the Aramaic records may have been earlier. Now, Woodard says, just count these decorations. So we have chevrons and dots, and it turns out to be 21 of them, and there were eight lines below the bird, so that would be 821, which is 67 A.D. And that makes sense, that they should have traveled down to Egypt to this scribe that we'll talk about in a few weeks, who put together these manuscripts. Now, that's before the destruction of Jerusalem, but it's during a persecution period in which the Romans were invading and the apostles had left. You remember the Christians were told to leave Jerusalem. And Egypt is close. It's not very far away. And so Egypt was a haven for Christians in this period of time. And so that's where they took their manuscript, and that's where the scribe put this Matthew together. John came much later. You remember he was exiled on the Isle of Patmos in the time of the Revelation. And I had given you all a history of Revelation here a couple of years ago, and we talked about the fact that there's a good argument. It isn't conclusive, but there's a good argument that it was done, that this revelation to John was given to him before the destruction of Jerusalem, which would have been in the late AD 60s. And I think that the gospel was what was written late, because his spiritual bent in the whole story was probably colored by his experience with this direct revelation from God. But anyway, if you count the feathers, 6, 12, there's 5 here, 17, 21, 25, and so on out, there's 50. The last one is a single, you see, is a single feather here. 850 AUC would have been 96 AD. And that would have been the last of the Gospels to be written. He had before him the other three Gospels, and he could see what they had written, and he didn't have to copy everything that Matthew, Mark, and Luke had put into them, he tried to put his own expression into his gospel. Luke, now you count the dots, and there's some evidence in a lighter ink here that someone went along there and made tick marks counting these things off. And there's 27 of these dots in the middle of this double helix. And that would have been in 827 AUC and 73 AD. So he came along some 6 years after Matthew had come. And Mark was even later than that. He came along a year before Luke. And so we count the feathers on the tail here. There's no bird, but the material across the manuscript would give us a date of 72 A.D. So Mark and Luke may have actually been there at the same time. And that's not surprising. Luke's manuscript was put together after research. And we're going to talk about that and spend some time on Luke's gospel in a few weeks. The other, Matthew and John, of course, were eyewitnesses. They were with Jesus throughout his ministry. And Mark apparently was an outsider who watched that whole process, living in Jerusalem and being a Levite associated with the priesthood there. He followed what Jesus was doing very carefully, and he had a presentation which was slightly different and directed more toward the Gentiles. So here are, and maybe that's the reason why these tales are different, is that that each of the Gospels were slightly different. Now, when it comes to the copies that are made later, maybe made in the 300s, and this is one that we've talked about, the Sinaiticus. Here, the scribe seemed obligated, and this is John's gospel, seemed obligated to put something at the end of the gospel, but he didn't really give us any information, did he? Just a squiggly line. But that was the last of the gospels, and this is unique to the last gospel of the four. Now, something else that shows up in these. We look at Mark's gospel in Sinaiticus, and it does have a diagram like the ones that we see in Codex W. Now, here again, there's eight dots beginning here and going up, maybe just seven before you get to the tail. There are three chevrons on the left. This is kind of like the one that we saw for Matthew. And the tail runs over here. There are 11 chevrons. And then he switches to a different kind of tail, and there are 22. It's on two different lines. He ran out of space over here. And down below, we have 16 dots. Now, it doesn't use lines like Codex W did. But apparently, these represent centuries. If that's the case, this is when the document was first composed in 811 AUC. You see, this is earlier than the gospel that we have in Codex W. And it ends in verse 8 of chapter 16. Apparently, Mark had an earlier version of his gospel that he allowed to be copied, and it wound up here. And this is the note that I said was in the NIV at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, where it says, two of the oldest manuscripts do not contain the last 12 verses. So, here's an early version copied, and I think the actual copying of that, if the three chevrons over here represent, this is the third transcription, it's a copy of a copy of a copy, maybe, I'm just guessing, what do all of these marks mean? We don't have any guidance about that, but that would make sense that this was actually a relatively late copy of Mark's Gospel in the Sinaiticus all the way up in the 800s, 868 A.D., if we interpret it that way. And so take this with a grain of salt, because I don't have any inspiration about it, and we're nearly through here. The endings of the Vaticanus Gospels also have symbols, but instead of birds, they have a leaf. This one has birds, and this is, it turns out, is Mark. It also ends in verse 8 of chapter 16, and it also has a diagram like the ones in Codex W, with 8 dots and lines above and 8 dots and lines below. But a very short tail, which would suggest that it's a copy of a manuscript, an early version of Mark, that doesn't include the endings that we have in our Bible. But the one in Codex W does, carries it all the way out to verse 20. And that's the one that's accepted in modern Bibles. So, what kind of rules, the fact that they use leaves instead of birds, although here appears to be some birds in the middle of this one, 3 birds, I think, is what I saw. Don't know what the differences are. The rules are changed in some way. But the leaf documents have double dots. And notice here the long dots are at the top, the short indication of years is at the bottom. They may have switched things around. I don't know what they're doing. And nobody gave us an instruction manual to interpret the pictures. Okay, so realize that that's the case. But it is interesting. And look at the one at the end, John's. Boy, they got really decorative here, didn't they? But there's 8 dots at the top, and there's 8 dots at the bottom. There's a dot in the leaf, and there's a bunch of dots in the helix over here. And that must mean something. And we need to put all of that together into a consistent story, if we can. But we have to realize that over hundreds of years, the rules change, don't they? So we don't really know. But the fact that 3 of these are almost identical in the case of the Codex W suggests that, and were done by a single scribe, suggests that there was a set of rules he was following. And it also is consistent with the fact that those 3 Gospels are very early. Okay. Here is the Codex Alexandrinus, the symbol for Mark's Gospel. And it's only the bottom half of the vertical here, and then the tail that goes across. This tail, when you look at it, is similar to one of the tails in the Codex W. But if you count all of the little feathers on the helix across here, I don't know what that means. But this version of Mark in Codex Alexandrinus is complete. It includes the last 12 verses of the Gospel of Mark. That one has essentially what we have. Well, it is a copy, a Greek copy of what we have in your Bible now. So, don't know how to interpret this. We don't know exactly why that's so long, but this is verse 20, which is reassuring. This is the one of the 3 that includes what Mark had put in Codex W. So, conclusions, and you have these on your handout, but you don't have conclusion 5. We'll get to that in a minute. At the conclusion of each gospel, the scribe has placed a symbol or a diagram that may be an indicator of the dates when the manuscript was created and copied. Once again, why not just write a number there? Well, it may be putting the symbol there calls more attention to it than just having a number. And the problem with numbers was, what? They have numbers. What'd they use? They use letters for numbers. And so both in the Hebrew and in the Greek, they would have put a scribble there which would be misinterpreted perhaps Acts as a word, and when really what they wanted to indicate was a date. And so they did it with, I think that's the reason, is that there was ambiguity with trying to write numbers using words, using letters. So, we have no guidance for interpreting the symbols. That is probably the major point to be made. If somebody had taken the time to sit down and write a paragraph saying, when you see a symbol like this, this is what this means, this is what this means, this is what the tail means. No, and maybe they did that. And maybe we'll find a scrap of papyrus or something someday that has a story about these symbols on it. But so far as I know, no one knows how to interpret the symbols. It has to be solved as a puzzle, you see. Did you ever get something like that and have to figure out what the puzzle meant? And it is an interesting thing. I should think that a group of graduate students could spend 50 years on something like that and trying to figure this out. But it probably is something that could be assigned to someone to try to make some sense out of it all. And I'm befuddled even by the four that we have in Codex W without going to the others that we just saw. The AUC dating scheme would be the logical choice for the first century AD, since Anno Domini, what does that mean? That's why it's called AD, the year of our Lord. That notation wasn't invented until 525 AD. The interpretation of these diagrams by Lee Woodard placing the gospel manuscripts in the first century is consistent with other evidence that the manuscripts were still being modified by their authors. And those were the things we emphasized last week and before Christmas when we were talking about this, that there's evidence that they were working on them as they were transcribing them and still making changes in them, and that could only be done by the authors themselves. And certainly the authors were still alive at that point in time. Seven lines above the bird may mean that the gospel was begun before 46 A.D., and eight lines below the bird would indicate a copy date after 46 A.D., that is, after AUC 800 plus some years, which would be indicated by the detail in the tails that run across horizontally after the bird. So, there you have it. Diagrams. What do we make of them? I think Lee Woodard is on the right trail here, and that we are talking about early manuscripts, first century manuscripts. Now, you want to take that skeptically, in a sense. You don't want to swallow something just because somebody said it. But on the other hand, the evidence is mounting. You see, we've talked about the seals. We've talked about these. And I'm going to give you some evidence next week that will add to this. We'll continue to look at details of these manuscripts and find additional evidence that suggests that they are indeed manuscripts that the authors laid their hands on. Okay, thank you very much. That's all for this morning. If you need a handout from previous week, see me. I have some up here.